Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Meta. This episode, we're continuing the conversation with Soshi Simpson and Rebecca Banky, where we are talking about trying to create welcoming gaming spaces. So, Zosia, we were just talking a little bit before starting this record, and there was something you didn't get the chance to talk about during the last episode, and why don't you start us off sharing that?
Sure. So we were talking about previously about, just communication with, with people. If you meet somebody who is, kind of just outside of what you're normally used to hanging out with or seeing, and sometimes it feels a little bit, I don't want to say intimidating, but, there are a lot of fears that you're going to mess up or, say something wrong. And, and sometimes that can be overwhelming and scary. And one thing that I've noticed players do as they're playing games against somebody who is new, and I especially see this at conventions, is at the start of the game, you'll hear one person say, "Hey, I'm kind of new to this game. I don't play very often, or I'm not familiar with this faction. I've never played this faction before. If I make any mistakes, please let me know. I'm not trying to cheat you on purpose. I'm not really familiar with it." And it's a level of communication that I think that if players could take just away from the table and apply it in other situations in their lives, that it could make a lot of social interactions a lot easier, easier for everybody involved, easier for you as a person who's trying to, be welcoming and be inclusive and be, just a good person and a good community member. And it also makes it easier for other people who, as we've talked about previously, you might not always feel super welcome and, feel like they fit in, and just have a few more obstacles in their way to get to a place where they can feel welcome. Communication like that can really take down those obstacles and just make it smoother sailing for everybody involved.
Yeah, totally. So we probably have an obligation on this War Machine theme podcast to connect everything back to War Machine in our metaphors. I like it.
That's all right. I date Jake Van Meter. Everything is a War Machine metaphor.
I love it.
So here's another topic we can discuss that I think is actually a little bit difficult to have a good answer to. But let's say that you have a member of your community who, for whatever reason, they kind of refuse to participate in creating a welcoming space. So what do you guys feel is a good way to respond to that?
What's the nature of the refusal? Because that's important to investigate.
Sure. Let's say that this person loves to read or listen to Jordan Peterson and has very strong views on how the world is and should be, and that by being welcoming to certain types of people, they are harming society. I'll say that I've seen this more so online than in person, and this is probably a good second topic after this, but talking about creating welcoming online spaces, because it does feel like people tend to behave differently online than in person a lot of times.
Sure.
But maybe we can start with this one first.
So I think there's something really really challenging about the kind of individual you're talking about. One of the things that makes them difficult to engage with is the sort of ideology that they've adopted. And I think any kind of ideology that, and people are going to have different opinions about, does Jordan Peterson or does Jordan Peterson not say that certain types of people shouldn't really be. And I think, one argument is that he's just talking about free speech. I think I don't want to talk about that particular person because they invite a lot of prejudice. From my experience, is an okay thing to say. I think it's important that we give people an opportunity to participate in a conversation, and I want to help everybody participate. Unless they're actively trying to prevent other people from being here by being here. I guess part of my problem, Jay, is I don't have a lot of empathy for that particular individual. They've they've kind of gotten themselves into a very rigid manner of thinking. And in being in that very rigid manner of thinking, they haven't left themselves a lot of space to treat people like human beings. And I think if you're not willing to treat someone like a human being, then you don't really have a lot of space in my gaming community. And I think that's going to be a deal breaker for me. I have friends, you know, people who I care about and who I'm close to, who, you know, have talked excitedly. I mean, Jordan Peterson's basically a local internet celebrity.
Right.
He's from Toronto. He taught at the University of Toronto before they got rid of him. And, you know, his following is, you know, started as a nexus from, you know, Canadian undergrads. And my criticisms of him are that I feel like he, you know, employs academic rhetorical technique to teach people who don't have the academic rigor to engage in that kind of conversation. And also that he shills sort of self-help and bigotry. And I think I would, you know, my friends who've been willing to listen to me about those things, I've been pretty clear. And I've created a culture around our community where it's made clear that that sort of behavior and that sort of attitude isn't really okay. But the only thing you can do when you're interacting with a human being who refuses to accept someone else's humanity is tell them that it's not okay to be that way and not let them exist in the same space as you if they're going to behave that way, and encourage everyone else around you to do the same thing. There's different scales of that. Perhaps your gaming community is one that is willing to say, you know, if you're going to be that way, you can't talk about that. You can't bring that stuff up. You're welcome to hold that opinion, but talking about it is going to get you in trouble with us because, you know, we want to make sure everyone feels heard and welcome. That's great. That's an awesome gaming community. One step better would be, you know, if you're going to hold that opinion, we sort of see that as fundamentally a bit problematic, and we'd really rather that you didn't game with us if you're going to be a person who thinks that way. That's a bit more aggressive of a stance. You know, it's a way to be outspoken about your support, though, and that's cool. If you're looking for me to say, like, it's fine to be vocally transphobic, I'm probably not going to be your gal. I think there's some places where we can find middle ground. There's some places where we can say, you know, you're allowed to hold a more conservative view than me. I'm even okay with, I don't think the way you're living your life is right, and I would have a problem with it. But I'm willing to still call you the right name and treat you with respect and use the right pronouns. And I just need to privately acknowledge to you that I think what you're doing is wrong. And then we can move on and continue to exist in a space where I'm not going to be causing microaggressions. And I think that's actually pretty progressive of me. Like, I'm actually okay with that. If you're in that place, then fine. Like, if you're just not actively causing me harm, then I am okay with you doing everything else. And you can think whatever you want to think. I think it's defensible for someone to say, you know, if you're not going to be positive about me, or you're going to need to communicate to me that you harbor a negative opinion about me, I don't want to be around you. I think that's a defensible position, but that's not how I feel personally, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, my store is based in a very conservative area, but probably because it's owned by a gay guy, you know, we don't have problems with this very often. And I think most people who had an issue with that would self-select and go to a different game store. It does seem like, you know, this, I've mentioned in the previous podcast that the area I live is very religious. But one thing that I've noticed is a difference between the predominant religion in my area versus, as the example of someone who's like strongly follows Jordan Peterson or someone like that online, is that whether it's, I don't know if it's because of what Jordan Peterson does or believes, or because it's online, it's kind of what I alluded to before. Like, I don't have people telling me in person, like, you know, in general, that they think I'm going to go to hell, or that, you know, whatever. But when you remove the in-person interaction with people, it does seem like people say things online to each other that you would never say to each other in person.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a good segue. They're a big part of War Machine at this point is online interaction. And I guess that's just true of human existence period right now.
sure.
But what do you guys feel are some common things that have been pitfalls in creating welcoming spaces online?
I think the visibility of it.
Yeah.
I feel like just, especially like the Facebook groups. I mean, I think we all know that each War Machine Faction Facebook group is just usually just a cesspool. And there's, you know, at least once a week, there's always like just one topic that's brought up or, you know, something that's posted that just turns into a huge shit show, you know, 100+ comments of whatever it might be. And I view every single Facebook group kind of like just being a loud cafeteria in a high school mm-hmm. where everyone's just trying to yell and talk at each other. So you just have people, you know, sitting at their desk job, just furiously typing, you know, typing quickly. So like they're, you know, there are a lot of things at play. There's, you know, there's the high visibility of it. There's, you know, just immediate backlash and, you know, and so the high visibility, immediate backlash. And honestly, sometimes tones are just misconstrued. I think that's a huge part of just the online interaction is that sometimes when people are just trying to type very matter-of-factly, they come off as condescending and rude. And sometimes people who English is their third or fourth language, you know, they don't come off the way that they want to. And somebody else will, you know, immediately comment, you know, like, hey, did you even read this? Or, you know, what are you talking about? And there's a lack of understanding, you know, just kind of like what people are, you know, what someone's trying to say. The communication barrier breaks down very quickly online, which is a little bit ironic because Facebook is supposed to be great for keeping people in touch and communicating, but it ends up just being this just really just like a loud auditorium and everyone's just kind of yelling.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I've had the same experience. I had a really interesting moment the other day where we've got an election coming up in Canada in a couple of weeks, and it's a bit of a hot button issue for some of us where like one party's like, you don't really deserve to exist. Another party's like, we're not sure what kind of rights you should have. Another party's like, maybe just all of the rights. Anyway, it's been very controversial as a result. But I think one of the challenging things about it is, you know, everyone has a really, really strong opinion and they feel like it's life and death. And more often than it has been historically, it kind of is on some things. Elements of the conversation are actually very, very high stakes in a way that they weren't previous to this. And I think, you know, that's not necessarily the case with War Machine. Although sometimes it feels like it can be. Like for people who are like, you know, if what you're saying is true, then there's no point to me playing the faction I play at all. I mean, that's pretty high stakes for people. That's significant investment they maybe feel robbed of if they sort of are challenged in that way. I had a conversation with somebody, again, about this sort of very politically charged stuff where we disagreed pretty fundamentally on something. And I had a weird experience of it because I started typing a response, a quick, urgent, angry response. And then I got called away to a meeting for a couple of hours and I dealt with the meeting and I came back and I reread what I wrote and I was like, oh, that's not really particularly charitable or thoughtful and I could write that differently. So I rewrote it and I wrote a couple of paragraphs instead of the two lines I was looking for a zinger and I kind of wrote something a bit more thoughtful. And then I got called away again and I had something else I had to take care of. There was something going on and I had to address it and I dealt with it. And then I came back and I reread those few paragraphs I wrote and I was like, I talked better than this when I was in high school. Like I could, you know, make a reasonable argument and I could, you know, articulate a debate point well. And whatever happened to that version of myself? That it's absurd that I'm not doing that right now. So I took a few minutes and I wrote a good, nice, thoughtful, well put, eloquent argument that was respectful of the position he was coming from, that gave credit to the attitude that he had and the approach that he was probably taking, said things like, you know, I think I understand where you're coming from, and rephrased what he was saying in as charitable a way as I could. No intent to straw figure at all. Just, you know, I really think what you're saying is this, and my problem with that is this philosophical point and this thing. And in doing so, I wrote a much more reasoned and reasonable thing. And maybe I should do that all the time. Like, it sounds absurd to say out loud when you think about it like that. But all of a sudden, I was engaging in, you know, real positive conversation. And his response was also thoughtful and well-reasoned. And, you know, I felt like tagging the end of my comments. I didn't somewhat deliberately, but I thought about tagging it with, you know, sorry for the long post or TLDR or something like that. But I said, no, let's maintain the health of this conversation as reasonable and well thought out. And, you know, he did exactly the same thing in response. He made an effort to make his points articulate and clear and lengthy. And I guess I just wish we did a little bit more of that as online citizens. I wish our conversations were also a little bit more deliberate and positive.
Yeah. We don't always have that opportunity, though. And I think that's...
Sure, of course.
You know, and especially with like Facebook and texting and instant messaging, I mean, it's more of an immediate response. Yep. And we don't always have, you know, the few hours to kind of cool down, you know, and that's what it sounded like from your story. That's what happened is that there was, you know, you immediately wrote like this 2-line thing and then you got pulled away for a meeting and it gave you that time to kind of, you know, distance yourself from it, yep. You know, give yourself some time to, you know, decompress, really, really process it and look at it, you know, in a much more eloquent and logical way, which is great. It's wonderful. But we don't always get the chance to do that. And honestly, sometimes we're not, and this isn't necessarily a dig at anybody, sometimes we're not big enough to do it.
Sure.
You know, sometimes somebody will say something so egregious and so just ridiculous that you don't get that, you know, three or four paragraph explanation where I am considerate of your feelings and, you know, and hope for a healthy conversation. Sometimes you just get a fuck you. Like the end. And quite frankly, sometimes that's what people deserve because, and you know, and honestly, Becca, you are one of the nicest people I've ever met. You are very well spoken. You are so patient and kind. And quite frankly, I'm just not. big fucking surprise, right?
But no, that's a very thoughtful and direct thing to say.
But my point is that sometimes I don't want to give my emotional energy to other people.
Okay.
And quite frankly, that's what it comes down to is that when somebody says something ridiculous, you know, and I feel like, and sometimes I will do this. Sometimes I will have the emotional bandwidth to have that conversation, to be eloquent, to be, you know, empathetic and to be constructive and put something good into the, you know, into the internet and into the community. And other times it's just, there are always two sides to it. Like sometimes I'm just like, I don't want to put the emotional energy into trying to change somebody's mind because sometimes it's not going to be me that changes their mind. Sometimes people just, you know, we've said it before, like, you know, everyone's on their own journey. And sometimes people get to that point just on their own, you know, they just kind of look at it and go, oh shit, maybe I should grow up. And, you know, and they start making those changes on their own. And I don't know. I think it's great that you did that. I think it's wonderful that you had the time to decompress and you wrote something. And I'm so glad that that ended really well for you. And, you know, that it was a nice, healthy conversation. And the two of you walked away, hopefully with learning something, you know, both of you. But I think
not everyone's experience and it can't be everyone's experience.
It can't be because not everybody has the ability to do that. You know, not everybody has that kind of internet access throughout the day. Or quite frankly, even like just the patience or the tools to be able to do that. And, you know, like we're very, I think the community should be at least very thankful for people like you who will give good explanations and not just, you know, a bunch of multicolored middle finger emojis.
I don't always have it and I don't always do it either. And, you know, this is possibly the exception, not the rule. I think if you have the space and the time to ask yourself, you know, who's benefiting from my response here? Is this something that I'm saying that is an act of genuine solidarity with, you know, members of a community that I want to help lift up? Great. Is this maybe convincing somebody, maybe not the person I'm talking to, but possibly one of their friends or one of their friends of friends, that, you know, my views are positive and outspoken in a way that is going to demonstrate allyship or going to help someone else, you know, understand my point. Then that's great too. I worry sometimes that we engage in a kind of performative internet use. And my concern with that is that when we just kind of, and I'm as guilty of this as anyone else is, but when we just kind of like do some internet because it feels good to get that moment of dopamine release to say like, yeah, I told them what's what. What are we doing with that? Like, is that doing anything positive or constructive for us? Is that helping us, you know, be better versions of ourselves? Is that helping other people grow? Is that helping at all? Like, or are we just feeding a cycle of negativity? And if it's the latter, then would we be better served in a day where we don't have time to talk to that person and we don't have time to make a comment that feels positive and feels good, just not saying anything?
Yeah, I mean, that was actually something that a point I was going to make about the internet is that as I've gotten older, I've tried to implement this more, but just because I have an opinion doesn't mean that I need to share it on the internet. And there's a lot of people I think that could benefit from from learning that lesson. I don't know. Another topic that I think you kind of touched on this a little bit, Zosia, but I think it might be good for us to expand a little bit on. I think a lot of times people who come from minority communities or marginalized communities, that sometimes it can get exhausting to kind of have the expectation of being the better person or of being the teacher or, things of that nature. Have you guys, what experiences have you guys had with that?
It's a lot of work.
It is.
It can be worth it. I know that sounds a bit trite perhaps, but, I think that, you know, I've been called on the internet nauseatingly positive, and I think I resemble that sometimes. But I think it's also like, there's something really worthy about the process of just like engaging in that, but it's a lot of work, and people forget it's a lot of work, and people hold you to an expectation of engagement and advocacy and energy that not everyone can sustain. And I think that gets neglected sometimes.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's important to understand and know is that your first commitment or first responsibility is to yourself. And if you're currently not in a place where you're able to provide that to someone, it's not your obligation to do so. And hopefully you're able to have that level of self-awareness of where you're currently at. Cause there's some days where I have that energy or that ability to share with people. And then there's some days where I just want to lay in bed with my cats and I don't want to have to deal with this shit. and that's okay. So.
Yeah. And I think, that's another one of the many reasons why it's really useful to have allies. Because, you know, people who are helping do the sort of labor of engagement, they're a really big deal. They're a community of people who can just make it easier to be allowed to have a cat day, to have a moment where it doesn't have to be about this really, really intense advocacy that you have to do in this particular moment. And if you've got more tools, like on a given day, in a given moment, or in your entire life, it's awesome to be the kind of person who steps up and, you know, uses those tools to help people. Not everyone does. Not everyone necessarily can do, and that's okay. But I really appreciate it. It's nice for me.
So I guess I'd be interested. One of the things we talked a little bit about off the air was having an opportunity to share some personal experiences, maybe some coming out stories or, you know, I don't know what, but are there any experiences that you guys would like to share to allow people to get to know you a little bit better? Obviously there's no obligation to do so.
I mean, I'm certainly quite happy to share myself, but I've also been talking a whole bunch. So Zosia, if you'd rather, talk at this moment. I'm more than happy to let you go first.
I need time to think.
Sure. Okay. I mean, I can tell folks my experience. Obviously one of the things that's really fresh for a lot of folks, is me having come out as trans. That's something that I think not a lot of people in the War Machine community knew about me. And I think a very, very small number of people knew, and then, quite a few people got to know all at once. To that end, I think, you know, this wasn't news for me. Like, this was something that I knew about myself maybe from an age earlier than I had vocabulary to talk about it. I didn't know the word trans or understand what it meant to be wrong in that way, to sort of feel that way, that there's something, you know, that wasn't right about my lived experience. I came out to my extended family at a family reunion recently, and a great aunt of mine said, you know, when you were like 4 or 5, coming up on 6, you know, we weren't sure what you were going to be about. And we thought maybe you were going to be gay or something that was not quite wired the same way. But, you know, eventually, years later, that I guess kind of disappeared. And, you know, hearing her say that, I realized that was the moment that I learned how to hide that part of myself, this kind of element of my being that I'd managed to sort of cover up with a mask. You know, people who I knew in high school and college said that I was really, really good at kind of fitting in with a lot of different groups, talked about a sort of social butterfly-ness or a sort of charisma, a kind of natural ability to blend in surroundings. But it was a trained defense mechanism. It was something where I knew that there was this part of myself that I had to keep hidden because it didn't make a lot of sense and it didn't really belong. I tried to come out in my teenage years. I didn't, again, yet have the vocabulary to call it that necessarily, but I knew there was something wrong, and I started seeing a therapist, and I started looking into tools, ways that I could maybe make some significant changes in my life that would, I hoped, lead to dealing with some of this powerfully rooted unhappiness. I didn't get a lot of support and have a lot of success. My parents didn't have a lot of tools to understand what I was going through and didn't know where these problems were coming from. I attempted suicide. It's common. It's a thing that a lot of people end up going through at that sort of chapter or interval in their lives, who have some of those significant challenges and traumas. Didn't work, wasn't very good at it. So that was, I guess, ultimately a positive thing. In my university experience, my bachelor's degree is in philosophy with a minor in women's studies. So one of the things I learned during the course of my women's studies class was some vocabulary. I learned the ability to talk about what the experience I was having kind of could be called, that there was something about my identity that was maybe still valid or still real. It was something that there was still a developing vocabulary for, and I was taking a women's studies course, so there was a mixture of responses, but I got a lot of support from a really, really incredible professor who was patient and understanding and taught me a lot about when someone comes to you and they don't have all the tools, the temptation is to reject them. And the right answer is to try to help them. And she spent a lot of time really helping me with places where I didn't have the right answers and I felt like I must. After that, I told my partner, and she struggled with it for a chunk of time. She had previously identified as straight and had to ask herself a lot of questions about whether or not she was comfortable being involved with a woman, because again, the reality of trans people's experience is a lot of people think about it as you were one thing and are now another thing. But the truth of the matter is you kind of never were that other thing. You kind of always were the gender that you sort of end up asking people to accept you as. So, you know, that was already my experience. She was already dating a woman and she kind of had to decide if that's a relationship she wanted to stay in. She did. We've been together for 14 years this month. Absolutely wonderful. Been a huge part of my journey and amazingly supportive, and I'm glad for her existence. Having said that, you know, that was the point where I said, okay, I'm going to start telling some people and I'm going to figure this out. I was 21 and a little naive, and I felt like I finally had the tools to be able to have a positive conversation about this with some people who mattered to me. So I told a couple of my professors, and I told my sister, who was really supportive, and I told my best friend in a moment, walking up the mountainside campus that we were on, I went to school in British Columbia, so West Coast, you know, giant mountains. Walking up the side of a cliff where we had about 300 steps to get to a class every day, and about 150 steps to go before the class that we were taking that evening, he said to me, "You know, it's been really incredible becoming such good friends with you. I usually only become friends with women, and it's been really neat. And I've never connected with somebody this way before." And I said, "Well, if there's ever an opening, this is it, right? Like, obviously, this is my moment." So I said, "Well, this is a thing that I'm discovering about myself and going through right now. And, you know, maybe that's what this is all about. And isn't this a cool thing?" And he said, "Oh, you're going to hell." Which wasn't the answer I was hoping for.
Huh, yeah.
And it definitely shut some things down for me. And I kind of buried a part of myself for a chunk of time. And I said, "Okay, there's still something about this that's wrong with me. There's still something about this that isn't going to work. And I need to be a different person." And I tried to be a different person for a long time. And last year, almost 18 months ago now, in April, my dad died. My dad's the person who taught me and my sister D&D when I was six. He taught me gaming, introduced me to basically the line of work I'm in right now, directly or indirectly. You know, he's the reason in many, many ways for the person that I am today. And I had a lot of trouble with it. I didn't have a perfect relationship with him, and I didn't really know, you know, what to do with the feelings that I never had an opportunity to kind of deal with. He died really, really suddenly, and you know, was murdered, and his house was burnt down, and there was no, you know, deathbed reconciliation moment. You know, we'd reconciled a little bit before, but I thought I'd had years to rebuild a relationship with somebody who'd been really important to me fundamentally, and suddenly it was gone. So I went back to a therapist, and I would recommend therapy to anybody who's unsure if they're completely fucked up, because, spoiler alert, you might be, and it can help quite a bit. To that end, I saw a therapist, and I said, you know, I've got to get the right therapist. I went through, you know, my partner's extended medical, and I said, okay, you know, it's got to be somebody who is LGBT positive, because this is a truth about me that at some point someone's going to have to know, because, you know, someone can't help me if they don't know kind of the truth about me, right? And, you know, so not our first session, but our second one, I told her, you know, hey, also this thing might come up at some point. Just, you know, if it matters, it's there. Let's keep talking about the grief I'm experiencing in my situation with my dad. And she said, "Well, what's been the reason you haven't come out about that?" And, you know, I said, "Well, obviously everyone would hate me, and I wasn't sure how I would ever have that conversation with my dad." And she said, "Are you sure? Because there's stuff we can do here, and it feels like going through your whole life with this vague sense of self-loathing is gonna cause problems for you later on," which was remarkably insightful of her, because, you know, it probably would, and maybe already had a little bit. So that was the major catalyst for me. That was the sort of big reason that I decided that, you know, that was the next step for me, that was a process that I had to go through and wanted to go through. So then it was, you know, tell my mom and tell my family and get a doctor and start seeing a lawyer. And you gotta involve a lot of people in this sort of stuff when you want to make really important decisions, which is, I think, also a little bit unnecessarily challenging. But I think, I mean, I'm glad. I've never been happier in my own skin than I am now, you know, feeling the way that I am and living the way that I am. It's so much better. It's a night and day experience, a truly, and I mean, this is going to sound stupid to say out loud, but a truly transformative one. And I think there's, you know, if anyone's thinking like this might blow up my entire life, the answer is it's probably still worth it. Like it's just so hard to not live with that authenticity. And I'm very, very glad that I went through the changes that I did and have been able to live, as I say, more authentically. Yeah. Anyway, awesome. So that's more or less my coming out story. Like there's some little details in the minutia of it, but that's the big stuff.
Thank you very much for sharing that. I can go ahead and hop in now, I guess, and share a little bit about some of my experiences. So I grew up very Mormon in Idaho, and I think that I knew that I had attractions to guys from a fairly young age, but was obviously adept at hiding it. And I think that one of the effects that it had on me was having kind of weakening my self-image or my self-confidence. And so kind of the way that I tried to battle that was by trying to get approval for myself from outside sources, mainly from my family and from my church. And I told myself that if these people thought that I was okay, then obviously that all my doubts or concerns, I didn't need to worry about that as long as I had approval from them. And so I did a lot of things to try to overachieve so that I could earn their love and earn their approval. And so, you know, I was an Eagle Scout and I was a valedictorian and did all these things to try to earn their love. And so at one point I went on a mission as a Mormon mission to Central Florida. And while I was on my mission, I had a conversation with my mission president and told him that one of the things I was struggling with was having attractions to guys. And he said that he would need to talk to kind of the leadership in Salt Lake City and know how to respond to that, because he was kind of new to his job, but we had a good relationship with each other. And so he got back to me and said that I could either come home off of my mission or and have an honorable discharge, or I could stay out. And if I stayed out, then I would do some counseling through LDS Family Services. And the purpose of the service of the counseling would be to kind of try to turn myself straight. And so,
sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but it is really, there's nothing quite like the attitude that accepts that's a possibility.
Right,
I mean,
right.
For me, like it's just, it sounds so absurd. And I know that that's not how it must feel for people who are in that experience and who live that way. But the idea of turning someone straight is just so bizarre to me. Like,
well,
but, and I guess, yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Jay.
Sure. That's fine. I'll go ahead and share some of the experiences behind that, because, you know, in retrospect, it's kind of amusing, but, I'm assuming that people will find it kind of interesting. So I didn't have any of like the electroshock aversion treatment or anything like that. Kind of the guiding principle that the therapy had at this time that I went through was that, so they believed that little boys, they're all gay, and that, And you can tell this because if you look at a 6-year-old, he'll think that girls have cooties and he doesn't have any interest in girls. And then as he grows up emotionally, this naturally shifts and he becomes attracted to girls. And so the problem that gay guys have is that they have not successfully grown up emotionally. And if the counselor can help this gay guy to grow up emotionally, then his attractions are going to naturally shift and he'll become attracted to women. So,
sorry.
Holy shit, people believe this?
Oh, yes, yes. So, you know, I started counseling with these great hopes that, you know, I'm going to go through counseling and I'm going to be straight and I'm going to then be able to live the Mormon dream and marry a woman and have a bunch of kids. And this is fantastic. And so I did the counseling, and the thing that's sort of funny about the counseling is that it feels kind of like they took a lot of stereotypes about gay guys and said that they were kind of causative to being gay. And so as an example, they said that, you know, if you developed more of an interest in sports, or if you had more friends who were male peers instead of female friends, or if you had a better relationship with your dad, or, you know, things like that, that if you're able to do those things, then that's going to help you grow up emotionally, and then your attractions will shift. And so In my first session, my, you know, my counselor, he said that he kind of presented this theory to me and asked about my relationship with my dad. And my homework was that I was supposed to write a letter to my dad about, you know, what was wrong and with our relationship and how it could get better. And I could decide whether to send that letter or not. But me being the overachiever and believing that, you know, if I send this letter, that's going to help me heal and become straight that much faster. And so, you know, my poor dad has his son out on a mission and he receives a letter out of the blue that says, you know, I'm attracted to guys. And part of the reason why is because we have these issues with our relationship. And so,
sorry.
In retrospect, I feel bad for him. I finish my mission, and as soon as you finish your Mormon mission, it is the expectation that you will start dating and soon thereafter get married and start having a family. So I start dating, and at one point I'm dating someone pretty seriously, and she says that she wants us to get married. And I say, my response is that, well, I think we should keep dating. We should, you know, just do that for a little bit longer. And she said a couple times to me that she felt like I was holding something back from her. And so eventually I told her, you know, I have been holding something back. I also have attractions to guys. And she said, well, you know, we can work through this. It'll be okay. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, she came back to me and she said, you know, I don't think we can work through this. I don't think this is going to work out. Thank heavens she said that. And yeah. So I did kind of an evaluation at the time. And I was like, I've been trying so hard to make this work and it's just not working. And that was the time when I went out on a date with a guy for the first time. And it was a night and day difference. And so at the time I was in kind of a leadership position with my church. And so I went to my bishop and said that I needed to resign that position and explain what was going on. And he asked me if I wanted help to change. And I said, yes, I do. 'Cause with all my heart, that was what I wanted. And so I started a second set of counseling with using the same principles that, you know, if I would just grow up emotionally, I was going to finally become straight. And so I started the counseling with high hopes, and by the end was very depressed and told them that, you know, this wasn't going to work. And I actually ended up started dating someone at that time. And I told them that I was dating them. And so at that point, I was excommunicated from my church. And the Mormon church was something that's always been very important to my family. And so as I was dealing with coming out, the two things that I had kind of based my self-confidence on, being reassured from my family and from my church that I was okay, those things were all of a sudden gone. And so at the time I was in university and I had a full ride scholarship. It'd been going fine. And as I dealt with coming out, I just flunked everything and could not manage my life at all. And you know, the person I was dating, we were in a relationship for a while. Eventually he dumped me because I was not in the state to be a good partner at the time. I had transferred to him kind of, you know, the thoughts of, you know, if he thinks that I'm okay, then I'll be okay. And so when we broke up, I had a lot of issues with being suicidal, with suicide attempts, with being self-destructive. I ended up dropping out of school. And the only thing that ended up turning things around was basically a lot of intensive counseling. And, you know, it's been a long road since then, but I can say that I'm very happy to be leading the life that I have now in the position that I am now. I think back to, you know, for example, if I hadn't dropped out of school, you know, which at the time seemed catastrophic, you know, right now I would probably be a database administrator, which sounds much worse to me than what I get to do now. So it has been quite a journey.
Yeah, that's beautiful, Jay. I mean, it's a sad story sometimes, but it has a happy ending, right? I mean, I think that's...
Yeah.
Yeah. Trauma shapes us one way or the other.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, hopefully we're in a position to walk away from it, you know, whole or even more complete with better lives, or at least more real ones. Not everyone has that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's a struggle we have to be honest about.
That's true. 100%.
Well, we're getting close to the end of time on this one, this episode as well, but is there anything that either of you two would like to share, or any topics that we would like to cover?
I'm still reeling a little bit. So yeah, you've got a little bit of time to think here. Do you want to share anything? It could be a funny one. It doesn't have to be really profound.
No, there are no breaks on the depression chain. All right, let's dive right into this one. My mom died when I was 11. It was the first dead body I ever saw. No, that is true, but I'll break a little bit more. Sorry, let me back up a little bit more. I was smuggled into this country when I was 4 years old. So we're going to start there. And so my mom was 40 years old, and she wanted to have a kid. She was unable to adopt in the state of Massachusetts, or at least this was the story that I was told, because of her age. So she sought to adopt a child outside of the states. She went to the Philippines to adopt me, apparently really bad with following instructions and doing paperwork, and also impatient. So she decided to just bring me into this country anyway. And she was like, I'll just sort it out later. Fast forward 10 years, she died. Did not sort it out. So I went through high school, and my family was so I was adopted, white, Irish, Italian, Catholic, Republican family, to just really set the stage. It was great. It was not great. Throughout high school, there was always pressure on me to perform and do well, and, you know, always have straight A's and, you know, just always do well. You had to, you know, reach for the ceiling and, you know, or reach for the stars or whatever the fuck the saying is. Low. And I worked really hard for it, and I got a full scholarship to the college that I wanted to go to. Which, fun fact, when I was in high school, my goal was to join the Marine Corps. I spent years training to get myself physically fit to be able to join the Marines. I got a full scholarship to Norwich University. Which was my dream school. I was going to go there, do the ROTC program, hopefully graduate and go JAG and become a judge advocate general in the Marine Corps. That was my goal. I wanted to be a lawyer and I wanted to be in the Marines. And I had all these dreams. And I got to my junior year of high school and hit my head really fucking hard on the glass ceiling when my aunt and uncle sat me down and told me that I was not in this country legally. So that was fun. Yeah, so that was great. Kind of similar to you, Jake. I kind of just went self-destructive, started just failing my classes, not even going to them, sleeping through them, just not really doing well. Like, I was the only kid in 6 AP classes who was like, I don't give a fuck. And it wasn't healthy. It was a lot of it internalized because I wasn't allowed to be angry about it. I wasn't allowed to be like, hey, someone fucked up really hard here. It was always, we'll figure it out later. There was a lot of procrastination, which probably is why I am pretty good with paperwork now. my job is compliance and checking paperwork for the company. And I inspect everything very carefully and make sure that all paperwork is in order. It's a sore spot for me. But aside from that shit show, growing up in an Italian, Irish, Catholic, Republican family. And both sides of the family, Irish and Italian, were both first or second generation immigrants. So I never really understood the racism and the hatred toward immigrants, because I'm like, yeah, but you are too. which I got smacked for pointing out that my uncle was an immigrant. I was like, this isn't a secret. Like, we all know this. Like, we've talked about it, how you came over here when you were nine, but I was an asshole for like pointing it out and equating us, you know, basically putting us on the same level, being like, look, we were both born in other countries. And it's been really, it was really weird. It's actually something that I've been struggling with over the past 3 years, is really kind of coming to terms with what being Filipino means, you know, kind of like understanding the culture, trying to learn the culture. And I feel very far behind the ball because I'm in my 30s and I'm just trying to, you know, learn some basic phrases and learn a little bit about the culture. But I was basically raised that it was a third world country and they were all savages, like legitimate words that I was always taught. Like I was taught that, you know, people from the Philippines, they no one speaks English. No one goes to school. All the girls are prostitutes. All the boys get sold into labor by the time they're four. But growing up in that, you're just like, oh, Jesus, that sounds terrible. Thank you for adopting me and taking me away from that hellhole. So it was a really interesting relationship that I had with just my identity as being somebody who was of color, you know, who was brown. And it was always really difficult because and I look back at it and I'm just like, how was I just okay with this? But like, just the things that were said around me, you know, about immigrants and about basically, so in my family, you were either white, black, or Mexican. There was no other race. There were no other colors. It was just, those were the three things that you could be. And I would hear like a lot of like just very incredibly normalized and just such casual, like just racist commentary, just, and I just grew up around it, from a really, really early age. Another fun fact, my uncle taught me to, when I was like 3 years old, he taught me to walk up to people and say, GI $5, because he thought child prostitution was hilarious. just so that we kind of get an idea of like what I grew up with. So, I mean, I don't have a very similar story in regards to, you know, coming out and I'm not trying to turn this into a pissing contest of, you know, whose trauma was bigger and shaped us more. But I guess the point of sharing that is that, I don't know, I guess that we all have, you know, we all have our scars and we all had our journeys that brought us here. They've all been painful painful and hopefully informative just in different ways. But over the past 10 years, I've been trying to do my best to learn more about, you know, where I came from and learn more about the country, you know, outside of the lens of racism and, you know, just really like learn about people. And it's part of why I love traveling so much, is just to meet new people and, you know, and to really kind of just shed the ignorance that I grew up with and just try to be a little bit more, a little bit more knowledgeable. It's
really kind of beautiful, Sasha.
Yeah.
I think you've told me bits and parts of that story, but never quite the whole thing like that. And it really, it hits you a bit of a different way, I think.
Yeah. So at least we're ending on a happy note.
Yeah. Well, thank you too very much for sharing those stories. It's courageous to do so. So I appreciate it. And thank you again for joining me on this podcast. I appreciate it. Hopefully it's something that can be helpful to the community.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Yeah, I mean, I hope something that we said here kind of connects with people or resonates. I really like that.
Yeah. So thank you again, everyone, for listening. And thank you especially for backing this Patreon project. And thank you for listening.